Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the Dallas Police Chief's remarks that society is asking too much of police officers, expecting them to be mental health professionals, marriage counselors, dog catchers, and school monitors. Lisa Campbell, who comes from a family of police officers and served 20 years in law enforcement, joins us to discuss both sides of the issue as a female African-American police officer and someone who does not want to see black brothers and sisters gunned down by either the police or gangs. She will discuss her new film, Shoot, Don't Shoot, a documentary that tries to bridge the gap by addressing the underlying issues leading to the escalation of violence by and against the police in urban communities like Chicago, Baton Rouge, St. Paul, and Dallas. Then we'll investigate the possibility that Putin is tipping the scales for Trump against Hillary Clinton, since it was Putin's propaganda outlet, RT, that first published hacked emails in March of 2013 from Hillary Clinton's private server that first led to the revelation of the server that has dogged her campaign. Jacob Halperin, a senior editor at The National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, joins us to discuss Putin's ties to General Michael Flynn, who is apparently Trump's favorite pick for vice president, and Flynn's new book, co-authored by the prominent neocon Michael Ledeen, The Field of Fight, How We Can Win the Global War Against Radical Islam and Its Allies. Then finally, we'll look into the resumption of the civil war in South Sudan that has already wreaked havoc and death upon the world's newest country, whose leaders have all but destroyed their country over the personal rivalries between the president and the vice president. Lako Tongan, a professor of international and intercultural studies and political studies at Pfizer College, who was born and grew up in South Sudan, joins us to discuss the head of the UN's recent and urgent call to massively reinforce the UN mission after two Chinese peacekeepers and a UN staff member were killed, along with hundreds of civilians. And joining us now is Lisa Campbell, who served 20 years in law enforcement and comes from a family and community of police officers. Her mother, father, and brothers, uncles, and cousins are police officers, and she worked in jails, courts, and the streets, and has worked investigations and conducted background investigations for the Los Angeles Police Department. She was born and raised on the south side of Chicago and grew up amid a culture infested with gangs and gang violence and offers a unique and raw perspective on the political impact of policing. She is currently finishing a film called Shoot, Don't Shoot, a documentary that will attempt to bridge the gap by addressing the underlying issues that have led to the escalation of violence by and against the police in urban communities like Chicago, Baton Rouge, St. Paul, and Dallas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Campbell.
Thank you. Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Lisa. And I don't know whether you caught the remarks by the Dallas police chief, but he's become a very prominent figure since the shooting of the police officers in Dallas. He's an African-American. He talked about the conflict of feeling the pain of his fellow officers and being killed at the same time, concerned for the safety of his own son. And I take it that is a situation that you found yourself in, too.
Absolutely. It's a lie. I mean, it's interesting now that I'm a civilian, I'm on the civilian side of things, but I don't think it's much different. You know, first, I want to just say, give love and respect to all of the men and women in blue who get up every day with the right intention in. They get up with the intention to do the job that they're sworn to do, and they do it well. But unfortunately, it goes back to the many layers to this onion. If we look at the political impact of appointments, if we look at how police chiefs are appointed and how their budgets are regulated, we slowly begin to understand that there's a lot more here politically that impacts the hiring of law enforcement and the decisions to train and to cut budgets in areas that are now critical and crucial if we're going to affect change in how we police communities that we don't understand or that we don't relate to.
So when the Dallas police chief says, as he did today, that society asks too much of police officers, expecting them to be mental health professionals, marriage counselors, dog catchers, and school monitors, is that from your experience? I know, for example, here in Los Angeles, and particularly in beach communities like Santa Monica, Most of the homeless do have drug and alcohol problems and mental issues, and I do believe they take up an awful lot of the time for police officers. And we know from the shooting at the university in Santa Barbara, where the police visited the shooter based upon an urgent call, I think from his parents, who thought he was a danger to others. And simply because they're not trained psychological professionals, they weren't able to detect that this kid was about to do something terrible. And the kid himself, in his own diary, said how relieved he was that the police didn't come in and confiscate his guns. So I bring that up as an example of the expectation that police have to solve these problems when clearly they are society's problems and they ought to be dealt with more comprehensively.
I agree. There are some cities that are progressive and they have addressed those issues. But again, it goes into funding, what's allocated in the police budget, what's cut from the police budget, and many officers are ill-equipped to handle the escalating mental health crises that we're facing. There are far more dynamics, there's far more deprivation and oppression today on the streets than the average officer is trained or that's either trained or even equipped to deal with. And so we have to face it head on and say it all starts at the top. If you don't have politicians that are in touch, if you don't have politicians in touch with those communities, you can't expect the officer to have the tools or resources to be effective. And I think that's part of the problem. I think we saw over the past 10 years a lot of agencies lowered hiring standards. I'm going to just be honest. They made concessions where concessions should have never been made. And it's spilling out right now into our communities. You have officers that are ill-prepared, ill-equipped to handle the job, and you have bosses who don't stand behind the good officers that are trying to do the job, and it's just a mess. We have to deprogram and reprogram the police culture.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Campbell, who served 20 years in law enforcement and comes from a family and community of police officers. Her mother, father, and brother, uncles, and cousins are police officers. And she is just finishing a film called Shoot, Don't Shoot, a documentary that will attempt to bridge the gap by understanding the underlying issues that have led to the escalation of violence by and against the police in urban communities like Chicago, Baton Rouge, St. Paul, and Dallas. Of course, today, Lee said, presidential candidate Donald Trump came out with a Richard Nixon-type appeal that he would be the law and order president and get tough. And he's also said that he'd get tough in terms of military action and bomb the hell out of the Middle East, etc. One of the problems, and I think you just alluded to it, in terms of the recruitment of police officers, a lot are being recruited from having had served in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the criticism is that they have the mentality of soldiers occupying or patrolling enemy territory where they have to be on guard, and they take that mindset over to patrolling neighborhoods that they consider to be enemy territory. Is this a problem that you have come across?
Absolutely. I can attest to that on more than one level. I was a background investigator, once again, for Los Angeles Police Department. And in the personnel division, there was no secret that it was many investigators in that unit would speak out quite often about it. I remember at one point that there were soldiers, and don't let me tell you, I'm not taking a stab at soldiers. We're grateful for what they do and how they do it when they do it right as well. But some of them were coming out without even having to go through the training and the debriefing period from what they saw over in the war zones. And I remember having those conversations. But it was a numbers game. And they made these concessions, and now we are having to deal with it. There are psychological impacts that these officers didn't even get an opportunity to defuse from, and you put them out into the streets to protect and serve when they've been taught to do pretty much the opposite in the war zone. But I don't know if we're honest, if law enforcement was ever really designed to serve and protect. I think it was a catchy phrase that caught on and they put it on squad cars. But if we go back even throughout history and look at the legacy of law enforcement, we start with slave patrol. That was the first time people of color, black people of color, let me say that, saw an enforcer. And it was not there. They weren't there for our benefit. They were there to control and to capture and bring them back dead or alive. It didn't matter. And so then we spiraled down through our history past the unjust laws, Jim Crow laws, the civil rights issues, and we are here today because we have never stopped become remorseful because we can't reconcile without remorse and say, listen, we haven't always been on the right side of justice. We didn't get it. But now that we've got it, we've got to do some things differently. You have generations of police officers. I mean, clearly, I'm a byproduct of it. But we have generations of police officers with coding that was justifiable, never right, but justifiable, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And it's been passed down. And, you know, you can't ignore that. You have to start there authentically, have those conversations. How do we deprogram and reprogram so that we have more community-oriented and community-based qualified officers on the street that can deal with some of the dynamics that we face as a culture today?
Well, given that the Dallas Police Chief, David Brown, is, I think, being largely greeted as a impressive police chief, and apparently he has a very impressive record of having changed the culture in the Dallas Police Force away from a kind of, white supremacist, racist kind of culture into a sort of multicultural culture. Is that to say that police officers like you and Chief Brown can make a difference? And is that a part of the answer?
You know what? Part of the answer, if I'm honest, is officers like me when I was on the job, but many, many, many people that I work with on the job, and many of the chiefs in the film, we interview chiefs in the film. We go to people that were in positions to make change policies and affect change. And the one common denominator is that they're only given so much power. As long as, and I say this over and over again, as long as the police chief is appointed by a political head or a political figure who controls his budget, sometimes you have to worry about where the allegiance is going to be. Is it to the politician or is it to the community? We see that resurface over and over again. I commend the chief in Dallas because it takes a lot. And you're dealing with, again, a historical culture that has an ingrained sense of wrong action as well as right action. We can't ignore the days of drop guns. We can't ignore this is just now being captured on camera. We have to retrain the community. You know, we as officers, you're trained that in the Midwest, I'll use Chicago. You know, now that you have people carrying and concealing, you know, that's a foreign concept. Until recently when CCWs or concealed weapon permits were issued. Police prior to that had been trained, to protect life, and a weapon would put you in imminent fear of great bodily harm or death. So you rush to judgment if you see a gun, and now that people are allowed to put guns, we need to work on how...
Well, it seems very clear, though, Lisa Campbell, that the gun issue is inextricably bound in these recent tragedies. First of all, in St. Paul, the Castillo was killed largely because of the gun, and he's the lawyer for the police officer who killed him has said that the gun, the mere possession of the gun, as the NRA tries to tell us that guns prevent violence, but this is a clear case where the possession of the gun attracted violence. And in Dallas, when the shooting first broke out, amidst the demonstrators, amongst the Black Lives Matter demonstrators and others gathered peacefully in Dallas, a number were carrying assault rifles because Texas is an open carry state. And that created an enormous amount of confusion for the police and a lot of danger. And a lot of danger, by the way, for the people carrying the weapons.
Absolutely.
So don't you think there's a crazy kind of element here in this country because of the NRA's fundamentalist views on the Second Amendment?
Absolutely. I mean, there is a craziness, and if we don't address it, it will become an epidemic. You know, we have an uptick right now, but let me tell you, there are two things. One, if you go back to the name of that presidential candidate that you mentioned, if we allow that person to get any more momentum or power, my fear is that you are going to see more of this radical insanity. Because you don't, we're not grounded, we're not connected, we're not having the tough conversations. We don't really have a lot of smart people making those decisions. They're making decisions that are popular based on votes. That's why it's extremely important that you understand, you know, what you're doing when you're going to the polls and that you go to the polls. Because when we look at the Second Amendment right and the times that we live in today, we've got to adjust it. We've got to adjust and we've got to educate. And if we don't, unfortunately, I think we'll see a lot more of what we are dealing with now. I think we have to tell young black men particularly that even if you are licensed to carry this weapon, there are certain things that you have to be prepared to do if you encounter a police officer. And I'd like to think that we're having those conversations in roll call and that we're having training and that recruits in the academy are being taught this. But, you know, just if I'm honest, I'm not sure that's happening at the level that it needs to be impactful. Again, it goes back to if I've got soldiers coming out and going straight to the streets, a six-month academy does not program four or five tours. So we're going to see a lot of this rush to judgment. I know one of the commonalities that I saw when I was with LSPD is that you have people who had never had complications in their life, and it seemed as though the questionnaire was strategic for that. You know, if you've never had conflict or confrontation, the first time you deal with hostility or aggression is when you're on the street. You don't rush to judgment.
Right. Well, in your case, Lisa, you did one of the great things that police officers can do, and that is you, as a Berkeley police officer, noticed a suspicious man with a young girl, and it turned out that this young girl had been kidnapped and imprisoned by this man for many, many years, and you led to the freeing of this hostage because of your instincts. And that leads me to the notion that police officers can do great things, and I imagine a lot of them that join the police force want to do great things. They don't want to end up killing people. They want to do good work. So how do you capture and build on that instinct?
Well, you do, you know, again, I always start with being thankful, because let me tell you, those are the people that I want to see when I'm in crisis. There are many women and men that go into this job and do this job for the right reasons, and they do the job very well. But the media would rather sensationalize Donald Trump. The media would rather sensationalize, the negative press, and not to say that that doesn't exist. But you've got officers that are now, for the first time in history, standing up against other officers. That blue code of silence is no more. You've got officers, if you follow any social media, that are very clear in conflict with what we used to say okay to, or we would justify, it's just not right. By the same token, you have officers that are standing in harmony, that are retired, that are coming out to support these young officers and provide knowledge, experience, and support, because we realize that the infrastructure is broken, and that started at the top with politicians, and the leadership is broken. You have bosses that are scared to react and scared to back a good officer. So the morale is so low. They are overworked, underpaid. They have cut the positions, and they haven't rehired. So you have one-man units where there's no way there should be a one-man unit. Backup is, far too delayed. And so people are saying, listen, I got to react quick because I want to go home at night as well. And we have to look at all of those underlying issues to understand the whole systemic problem.
Well, Lisa Campbell, I thank you very much for joining us here today. Hi, Lisa. I thank you again for joining us here today. And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Campbell, who has served 20 years in law enforcement, comes from a family and community of police officers. Her mother, father, and brothers, uncles, and cousins are police officers. She's worked in jails, courts, and the streets, and has worked investigations and conducted background investigations for the Los Angeles Police Department. She was born and raised on the south side of Chicago and grew up amid a culture of gangs and gang violence, and offers a unique and raw perspective on the political impact on policing, and is currently finishing a film called Shoot, Don't Shoot, a documentary that will attempt to bridge the gap by understanding, addressing the underlying issues that have led to the escalation of violence by and against the police in urban communities like Chicago, Baton Rouge, St. Paul, and Dallas. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing.
Because a few of them were white, and it's the same across the nation. Black and white discrimination, yeah, and you can't understand me, and all that other jazz they hand me in the papers and TV, and all that mass stupidity that seems to grow more every day. Each time you hear something we'd say, you want to go and do your in, cause the color of your skin just don't appeal to him, no matter if it's black or white, because he's out for blood tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jacob Heilbrun, who's a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and a senior writer at The New Republic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Heilbrun.
Thanks, Ian.
And at any day now, Donald Trump is expected to announce his choice for a vice president. There are a number of obviously, Newt Gingrich and Mike Pence, governor of Indiana, are high on the list. But there's also this other name that's been floating around for some time, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, who is a registered Democrat and is also in favor of a woman's right to choose. So there are a number of indications that would suggest that he may not get the nod. But my indications are, at least what I've understood from the Trump people, is that Flynn has always been Trump's favorite. Do you have any insight into this?
Mr. Trump, as he likes to be called, has a distinct affinity for generals. He respects men who have wielded authority in the ranks of the military, and it's obvious that Michael Flynn is very congenial to him, not simply or merely because he was in the military, but also because he is a fan of Vladimir Putin's Russia. He attended a big celebration dinner for Russia Today, which is the Kremlin's prime propaganda outlet. And he offers a crusade against the Muslim world in his book called The Field of Fight, How We Can Win the Global War Against Radical Islam and Its Allies. That book, Ian, has been blurbed by no less an authority than former Senator Joseph Lieberman, who says the leaders of the next American administration would benefit from reading The Field of Fight that tells us how to win the global war against radical Islam. Flynn book was also co-written with none other than Michael Ledeen, a leading neocon.
I know him well, Jacob, since he's threatened to sue me for an interview I did years ago with the senior CIA official, Vince Canestrero, about the origins of the forged documents that were the basis, the so-called Niger documents that were the basis for the Bush administration's claim that Saddam Hussein was trying to buy uranium from Niger. Those documents were forged, and in the interview with Vince, I asked him, I said, well, I understand those forgeries were done in Italy by SISMI or SISDE, the Italian services, and he said, no, they were done over here. And I said, by whom? And he said, I'm not at liberty to tell you. And I said, well, if I mention the name Michael Ledeen what would you say? And he said, I'd say you were very close. And then within minutes, I get a threatening note from Michael Ledeen threatening to sue me unless I retract the inference. So
consider it a badge of honor.
I do. That's why I know exactly who this guy is. He's the uber neocon. He's their kind of godfather, isn't he?
What's fascinating here, Ian, you connect the dots. Joe Lieberman, leading neocon. Michael Ledeen, leading neocon. General Flynn, calling for a war against radical Islam. It's clear that Trump, who is a protean candidate, could easily lead to a resurrection of the neocons if he were to select Michael Flynn as his vice president.
And what would stop him then? I mean, the implication from what you're telling us is that Trump would run a campaign focusing largely on his claims that Obama has not been a good steward of national security and that he would win the fight against ISIS.
Yeah, but I think it would be much sharper than that. As you know, being familiar with American history, the staple of discourse on the right has been that there are internal traitors subverting the fight against foreign enemies. And that was, of course, a prominent theme beginning with Alger Hiss during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And to some extent demonizing liberals themselves as appeasers of Soviet tyranny. And today, essentially the same charge is being rehearsed against a so-called totalitarian radical Muslim threat that we actually have, as Trump has implied, and as many conservatives have insinuated, a traitor right in the White House, an actual Muslim himself, was not born in America and has taken every step that he can to suborn American security and to endanger it and place us in the hands of our enemies. So I think this would be very attractive to Trump. And given his record so far, the pragmatic thing for him would be to pick someone like Mike Pence, but Trump has not acted pragmatically during this election. So he could try and upset the apple cart by picking someone like Flynn. The only real downside for him would be that Flynn appears to be soft on social issues. He's apparently not opposed to abortion and does not believe that transgender bathrooms pose a vital danger to American democracy.
Well, he did have his run-ins with Obama, though, did he not? I mean, I haven't read the new book that he's co-authored with Michael Ledeen, The Field of Fight, How We Can Win the Global War Against Radical Islam and Its Allies. But my understanding is that's where Trump gets this idea that Obama won't even use the word radical Islam and that somehow he tied their hands in Afghanistan and wouldn't go after Assad in Syria. So what do you know about Lieutenant General Flynn's tenure at the DIA, as head of the DIA, and what kind of clashes did he have with Obama? I know, for example, that the DIA were the only people who got the right assessments on Assad. Everybody, including Hillary Clinton, said, oh, Assad's about to fall at any moment, so did Erdogan in Turkey. But the Defense Intelligence Agency said, no, it's not going to happen. So what do you know about Obama's relationship with Flynn when he served in the military under Obama's being the commander-in-chief?
Well, it's widely known that he clashed with Obama. And I think it's because Obama is more of a realist and was opposed to what Obama has always been fearful of, the consequences of intervention abroad, especially since the Libya mishap. So I think Flynn is clearly much more gung-ho about taking on the Muslim world. I mean, to write a book like he did, which is essentially an exercise in propaganda, he strikes me as more of the Douglas MacArthur type, than someone who, I guess you could say, he's MacArthur to Obama's Truman.
And again, I'm speaking with Jacob Halbrin, who's a senior editor at the National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. And previously, he was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at the New Republic. So I guess in terms of the relationship between Ledeen and General Flynn, a possible VP for Donald Trump, does that say that Flynn's become a neocon, or is it this just like how the neocon seized on Sarah Palin? You know, in other words, they Fred Barnes and Bill Kristol thought she'd be great, and they sort of foisted her on John McCain, thinking that she's an empty vessel that they could fill. That's always been there. That's why they like George W. Bush. I think, in fact, one of those.
Well,
go ahead.
Flynn has a lot more to offer than Palin because he actually has a long record in intelligence and in the military. So he carries a lot more credibility and intellectual heft than someone like Sarah Palin. I would say it's an alliance of mutual convenience. The neocons are very adept at disseminating ideas, and Flynn appears to be someone who vehemently disagreed with the Obama administration's approach to the Muslim world. He says that he was fired because of his emphasis on calling our enemies radical jihadis. So I think that I think that Flynn and the neocons see perfectly eye to eye on the threat from the Middle East. I mean, Norman Podoritz wrote a long article saying that after 9/11, saying that this was World War III. So this, what I believe is grossly inflated language, and is likely to produce the effects that they claim to be trying to defeat. I mean, I don't think that we should unnecessarily antagonize the Muslim world, and that that Obama actually has been correctly and prudently cautious. But Flynn and apparently Trump would take a much more bellicose course, one that the neocons have been touting ever since 9/11. I mean, this is what prompted George W. Bush to march to Baghdad.
So what then is the relationship? That we know there is a relationship between Flynn and Putin, but the extent to which, well, first of all, Flynn was employed by Putin's propaganda arm, RT, for a while. He went to their 10th anniversary gala in Moscow,
right,
and he sat two seats away from Putin and was heavily faded at the event. That doesn't necessarily say that he's what the KGB used to call a useful idiot or a fellow traveler. I mean, in his interview on RT, he more or less just said that we need to work better, the U.S. and Russia, and they have common interests, particularly in combating radical Islam, to quote his phrase. So, because it's pretty hard for me to get my head around the idea that the neocons are interested in working with Putin.
Well, that is the kicker. It would be interesting. Clearly, those probably who focus most on the Middle East would be most receptive to Flynn. A number of neocons like Bill Kristol are so anti-Trump that I don't think anything would persuade them to jump onto his bandwagon. But the fact that Michael Ledeen is clearly co-wrote or ghost-wrote the entire Flynn book, for that matter, is of pregnant significance.
Oh, no, there's no question. He's the sort of intellectual godfather of the neocons, and he's obviously one of their heroes. And he's always operated in this netherworld between policy think tanks and active sort of engagement in intelligence mischief. I mean, he's the guy that was behind the forgeries of the documents that linked Jimmy Carter's brother to Gaddafi. So he goes back a long way in playing games in that netherworld. But I'm just trying to get a sense of, you know, one, you have to assume that Putin is not just looking out to see who's the next president of the United States, but he may well be tipping the scales against Hillary and in favor of Trump. Because after all, the most damaging thing to Hillary Clinton so far has been this email server. And it only came to light in March of 2013 when Putin's propaganda arm, RT, published several emails between Hillary Clinton and her former aide, Sid Blumenthal, in quotes, as a public service. So that was, in other words, you know, the Russians are the ones that broke the story on the server. And that became the press, and the Republicans have jumped onto it ever since. That doesn't seem like a passive thing. And also, a very credible internet forensic organization has said that the Russian intelligence services have hacked into both the Clinton Foundation's server and the DNC's server, where they extracted the opposition research file on Donald Trump. Also, the head of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, who also has a show on RT Russia Today, he's saying he's going to dump a bunch of incriminating emails and exchanges that he's got with involving Hillary Clinton. So it seems to me that you could make a case there that Putin has been tipping the scales for Trump. But the one thing that I don't understand, because Putin's a smart guy, is he wouldn't want to be doing this if Trump's going to lose. And at this point, it looks like Trump's going to lose. So how do you figure that?
That's a tough one. It's obviously sheer speculation, and to the extent that Putin would want to become enmeshed in the U.S. election, certainly he wouldn't want to leave any tracks behind. So I doubt he has any hesitation about pricking Clinton if he could. You remember that she referred to his invasion of the Crimea as similar to Hitler's in swallowing up the Sudetenland in 1938. So I don't think that Putin would have any hesitation about causing a little pain to Hillary Clinton, but I doubt he thinks that he can actually sway the American election.
Well, but it's clear that he favors Trump from Russian propaganda within the country. They really speak highly of Trump and poorly of Hillary.
Sure.
And at RT's taken a strong editorial position in favor of Trump against Hillary Clinton. And so to that extent, he's tipped his hand. But, you know, obviously he wouldn't want Hillary to become president and then her, in their first meeting, say, "Thanks a lot, buddy, for trying to stop me from becoming president of the United States." You know,
it's certainly possible that Clinton would take a tougher line on Russia than Obama has. But, you know, with Trump, I also wonder, given the volatility of his temperament, if he wouldn't actually turn out to be a more unpredictable president than the Russians might like. Say, if the Russians actually crashed into an American fighter jet or something like some kind of accident occurred, I think Trump's reaction would likely be much more difficult to predict and not necessarily something that Russia would like to experience. The imponderabilities of Trump would give me pause if I were Putin.
Well, but as I said, as you've pointed out, if Putin is tipping the scales for Trump, he wouldn't want his fingerprints. And at this point, the connections that I just mentioned do seem to be fairly clear, at least in opening that can of worms with the server, which has become the real sort of cross that Hillary had to bear. So, but the only scenario under which Trump could get elected, as far as I can tell, would be if the Islamic State conducted an attack here in October or thereabouts. And if Trump did select Michael Flynn as his running mate and the campaign focused on that, we're going to take care of the Islamic State, and Obama has let us down, and you pointed out that the subtext for that is that he's sort of almost a traitor. If they run their campaign on, we can clean up house and do a better job, and then ISIS makes an attack, that's going to play right into their hands. Would that be the only way that Trump could get elected? I can't see him getting elected any other way.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And but how likely that is, I don't know. But certainly Flynn is the sort of person that Trump likes, someone who is an unpredictable choice with militant views, unhesitant about voicing them. And he'd have the added benefit of, at least on paper, being a Democrat who really is, it does seem to be more liberal on social issues. I mean, Trump is going to be looking to enhance his crossover appeal, if possible.
Well, he's already tried to go after Bernie's voters. He's made no secret of that. So that does make sense. Well, obviously, it's speculation, and we'll know in a couple of days who Trump has chosen. But I certainly am looking further into the possibility that the SVR and the FSB have been hacking into Hillary in order to tip
right.
the scales.
As well as the Democratic National Committee.
Exactly. So there is some smoke there. I thank you for joining us, Jacob Hubbard.
Thank you, Ian. And maybe Trump will surprise us all with a pick we've never even thought of.
And this conversation will be irrelevant, right?
Well, I hope not.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jacob Halbrun, who's a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for The Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at The New Republic. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Larko Tongan, who's a professor of international and intercultural studies and political studies at Pfizer College. He was born and raised in what is the world's newest country, South Sudan, now undergoing a resumption of a power struggle within its leadership. Welcome to Background Briefing, Larko Tongan.
Thank you, Ian. Always welcome your invitation.
Well, thank you, Larko, but it's always, unfortunately, with bad news. And, you know, we thought for a while the bloodletting in South Sudan had ended with an agreement that was made back in August of 2015. And, of course, the civil war began in 2013, shortly after the country became the world's newest country. And it's largely to do with a political face-off between President Salva Kiir and his former vice president, Riek Machar. And it's now resumed again. And this time, hundreds are being killed in the capital, and UN missions have been shot at and mortared, and two Chinese peacekeepers have been killed, along with a UN staff worker, which has led the Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, to call for a massive reinforcements of the UN mission, which will be discussed by the Security Council on Tuesday. So, I mean, I guess I've given a summary for our audience of the situation. Is there anything you can add to this?
First of all, let me thank you for that summary, and also what is going on actually at the UN. But perhaps I can add how to explain it. How do we explain this resumption of the conflict in South Sudan? You are absolutely right that I myself thought that, you know, we have put all this conflict, you know, that we had with Northern Sudan back, and we are going to pursue our development. And unfortunately, that is what has not been the case. But just to perhaps explain to our audience what the root causes of this conflict are. Why is this persistence of conflict in South Sudan? But it's not that South Sudan is bent on, you know, violence. One has to understand what is behind this violence, in a sense. And so if you can let me briefly to mention three factors that have contributed to this conflict. One is that there has been a militarization of ethnicity in South Sudan. Ethnic groups have been militarized. And that militarization means that there are a lot of guns around. And I've been going to South Sudan since actually the year before independence, 2010, every summer, except for the summer of 12-13. I was there last summer. I was supposed to go this summer to South Sudan, and I would have been actually Juba at this time. But I read the situation last summer that things were not going to be good because I saw the build-up to this exploitation that had just occurred. Okay. So militarization is a key issue because, again, historically, the war was fought under late John Garang, who was my colleague. We went to school together, where ethnicity somehow was emphasized, namely that even though we were fighting against a common enemy, there were divisions, ethnic divisions within South Sudan. In fact, one scholar characterized that period as two civil wars taking place, namely civil war against the North or between the North and the South, and civil war within South Sudan itself, within the guerrilla movement. And so this is what has reared its head, its ugly head, actually, as a result of this militarization. Now, what, again, is important is that the gun has become like a means, you know, to power. The gun also has become a means for ethnic groups to defend themselves. And so this proliferation, actually, of guns all over the country, and this was the fear that I had, actually, last summer, that the guns are all over. All these different ethnic groups are acquiring guns, not just because they want to be recognized by the government that they have a stake, you know, in the governing of the country, but also they want to defend themselves. But there is also the other dark side of it, namely that some people use the gun in order to survive, namely that they rob people, they rape, they do all this criminality because they are able to use the gun. As you know, our listeners know, that is what the gun really does when you possess it. Okay? So, again, I would say this is connected perhaps to Mao's dictum, you know. Power comes through the barrel of the gun. And I think that in South Sudan, since we have been taken, you know, seriously. The second factor that perhaps we can use in order to explain so that our listeners can understand is that there is, in fact, I would say, a clash of egos between the two leaders. And this is based on their background. Yeah? Salva Kiir is somebody who actually based his qualification to be a leader on the military. He did not acquire, you know, high-level education. He joined the military after high school, and he was an intelligent agent, actually, for the government in Khartoum. And so when he joined the SPLM, Sudan's People Liberation Movement in South Sudan, he had that background, that military background. And supposedly he performed actually very effectively in fighting against the North. And so he proved his skills, you know, his military skills. And so that is what he counts on, okay? That he has this, and in fact, just 2 weeks ago he said the liberation of South Sudan was what he achieved. It was his, actually. And again, if some of you know about African politics, this is what some of these post-liberation, you know, era leaders claim, like Mugabe, for example, in Zimbabwe, or Afwerki in Eritrea. They said they were the liberators, and therefore they are entitled to being in power, you know, until the Almighty called them, you know. So Salva Kiir has this mentality. And so he has this ego that is more militarized. Now, Riek Machar is a highly educated. He's a PhD from from the UK, you know, from University of London, I think, in philosophy. And so he's educated, and so Salva Bakir, who does not have that education, does not like Riek Machar. Riek Machar looks down on Salva Bakir. So you have, in a sense, the intellectual and the military having a clash. Now, how does this play out? The way it plays out is that they now recruit their ethnicities. Okay, their ethnic groups become the support pillars of their position. And so this, in a sense, is why ethnicity has been militarized and why also the gun has become the means for these two individuals to equip their ethnic groups militarily so that they can exert in this competition for power in South Sudan. Now, that is also a cultural aspect to these two groups. As you mentioned, Salva Kiir comes from the Dinka group, which constitute, according to, again, estimates, there is nobody really who knows how many South Sudanese are there. No census have been carried out. But the Dinkas are estimated to be like 25%. The Nuers are estimated to be about 15%. Okay? That is, the Dinkas are supposed to be 2 million. The Nuers are about 1.5 million. Okay, out of estimated population, as you correctly say, between 8 million and 11 million people. Okay, so the assumption that they constitute a majority is incorrect. And that is how, again, Salva Kiir group thinks that because the Dinkas are a plurality, not a majority, a plurality, thinks that they are entitled to rule South Sudan. And in fact, both of them has these ethnic claims, namely that the Dinka said they are entitled to rule South Sudan for 1,000 years. The Nuers have their own interpretation, again, embedded in their culture, and they say the Nuers are going to have somebody coming from the Nuer land to rule South Sudan, and that person is going to be a left-handed individual. And this is foretold by their priestess. The priestess of the Nuer foretold that the ruler of South Sudan was going to come from the Nuer ethnic group, and that person is going to be left-handed. And it turned out that Riek Machar is left-handed. And so for the Nuers, they believe that they are entitled, actually, according to that prophecy, to be the rulers of South Sudan.
Well, Lako Tongan, this, of course, at least the leadership, or the lack thereof, is not lost on the head of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, who condemned South Sudan's leaders, quoting, "Yet again, the leaders of South Sudan have failed their people. Rarely has a country squandered so much promise so quickly. What kind of leadership is it that resorts to deadly weapons and identity politics time and time again? Failed leadership." So just in the last couple of minutes, tell us about where the arms are coming from.
Absolutely. And in fact, you mentioned two Chinese peacekeepers killed. China has been a major supplier of weapons, as well as Russia. In fact, what Ban Ki-moon is proposing in terms of immediate arms embargo against South Sudan, Russia is opposed to it, because Russia thinks that that will undermine the peace agreement itself, which I think is really contrary to the common sense, you know, as to what is happening in South Sudan. Okay? So China is a major exporter, and I've been talking about this even at African studies conferences and so forth. The Chinese interest is oil in South Sudan. This oil was, first of all, previously, before the independence of South Sudan, was the Sudan oil for the whole country. And so China was the one that actually opened the oil pigots so that it would flow out to China and to the world market. And so it has interest in that. And in fact, before the oil was flowing out in 1995, the Chinese were supplying arms to Khartoum government in order to fight and kill South Sudanese. Which, of course, did a lot of damage. There is no doubt about it. That's why, in fact, I would say genocide was committed in the Sudan, I mean in South Sudan, even though you don't hear much about it. I mean, we lost 2.5 million people, according to UN estimates. And so China is one. Russia is another supplier. That's why it is hesitant, again, to go with along with the UN. To impose arms embargo. And again, you know, some of these countries like Russia, the export, you know, income come from, you know, from exporting weapons. And so South Sudan, with the oil revenue that was, was coming out, was able to buy. And in fact, for example, the use of these what they call gunship helicopters or helicopters gunships that are being used now, they are Russian made. They are bought from, I think, one of the eastern, what they call former Soviet republics, like, you know, Ukraine, because that is how they want to earn foreign exchange and so forth. The United States also is a major supplier through its support of Uganda, for example, that is Museveni, the president of Uganda. And Uganda is the only regional power that has intervened militarily in South Sudan on the side of the government. And so he funneled some of the weapons that he got from the U.S. and China to Salva Kiir Group. And so, but again, there is a long history of that. In fact, just in May, we were at a conference in New York. I was at a conference in New York, and a German scholar was focusing on the role of Germany. Germany was also a major supplier of this, you know, military rifles to Sudan. And then East Germany was supplying similar, of course, they were the one manufacturing their weapons, but supplying them to SPLA, you know, in South Sudan. So the two Germanys were actually competing as to who can supply more weapons, you know, sure, to each side. And so you end up actually getting a flood of these weapons that in the Second Civil War became more the tools of ethnic groups in order to assert themselves. And so these people who are these you know, countries that are now talking about imposing, you know, arms embargo against SPLA, for me, they are not honest as to what is going on really in South Sudan, as to who supplied those weapons.
Well, Lako Tongan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I appreciate that, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Lako Tongan, who's a professor of international and intercultural studies and political studies at Pfizer College. He was born and raised in what is the world's newest country, South Sudan, now undergoing a resumption of a power struggle within its leadership. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.